Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 983. Fascism 2017 World Tour Part 2. This is being recorded on November 7th of the year 2017. What I'm going to do in this program is to give a synoptic account of a number of different stories dealing with, obviously, fascism in various parts of the world. And then in future programs, I'm going to stretch out and do a more detailed analysis and partial reading of many of these stories. We're going to begin in Europe, and then we're going to swing over to Latin America, up to North America, to the Middle East, and ultimately to Asia. One of the major manifestations of fascism, however, I'm going to be detailing in a series of shows about Hindutva, that's H-I-N-D-U-T-V-A fascism, that is Hindu nationalist fascism, which through Narendra Modi and his BJP party, essentially a political cat's paw for the RSS, a Hindu nationalist slash fascist party that was the fount of the assassination plot against Mahatma Gandhi. I'm going to be doing a series of shows about that, so I'm going to leave that out of this part of our 2017 Fascism World Tour. We're going to begin, however, in Europe. And again, I'm going to cite the relevant articles, which will be in the description for the program. And then in future broadcasts, I will stretch out at greater length. Beginning in Europe, we're going to take a look at some very ripe elements in the Bulgarian coalition government. We don't hear much about that. We should note that during the Second World War, European fascism was far more than just Italy and Germany, and also Spain, although officially neutral. Under Francisco Franco, it was, of course, a fascist country. Also Portugal, this is not generally well known, but under Enrique Salazar, Portugal also was a fascist country. Germany is not a particularly large nation, and one of the ways that they were able to exert hegemony over really all of continental Europe up to the Ural Mountains, where their armies, to which their armies had driven in the Second World War, was to enlist the alliance of a number of other European countries. In addition to Germany, Bulgaria, Croatia, and other members of what had been Yugoslavia and what became for a time after World War II Yugoslavia, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, as well as Slovakia, and the Baltic states also collaborated with Nazi Germany. In Bulgaria, the Bulgarian National Front became a key ally of the Third Reich's, and elements of Bulgarian fascism were essentially snap frozen in the Cold War period and have begun to manifest themselves in the post-war period. There is a coalition government in Bulgaria. Bulgaria is now poised to assume the EU presidency for a period of time. And so in that regard, it is worth noting that there are some really ripe fascist elements in that country's coalition government. Again, with Bulgaria poised to assume the EU Council presidency, it is worth noting the following. This is from GermanForeignPolicy.com. Of October 9th of 2017, Bulgaria's European chorus and the coalition government of Mr. Borisov has manifested some really interesting elements. In addition to exhibiting anti-Gypsy or anti-Roma bigotry and anti-Muslim / immigrant ideology, something that European reaction and also elements of American reaction have embraced as well. There are some specific pointed fascist manifestations in the coalition government featuring Mr. Borisov, the Prime Minister of Bulgaria. That man, by the way, is Boyko, B-O-Y-K-O, Borisov. And in his coalition government, Pavel Tenev, T-E-N-E-V, the Minister of Regional Development, was forced to resign when he was giving the Nazi salute in front of a wax figure of a Nazi officer at a Paris museum. Another photograph, this of the department director in the Ministry of Defense, a fellow named Ivo, I-V-O, Antonov, A-N-T-O-N-O-V, was giving the Nazi salute in front of a German World War II tank. That picture is in the written description for the record, 983. An article that I think I'm going to, well, maybe I'll just excerpt this one rather than read the whole story in this program. There has been a fair amount of coverage of a move by Catalonia, the Spanish province, or a Spanish province, to secede from Spain. Catalonia is one of the most prosperous parts of Spain and one of the most economically productive, and they have been moving to secede from the Spanish Republic. Spain has essentially nixed Catalonian secession. What is worth noting in yet another article from GermanForeignPolicy.com from October 11th of 2017 is an influential post on the website of the German weekly Die Zeit, D-I-E, capital Z-E-I-T, has advocated the dismembering of Europe's nation states. The author of the article, Ulrika Gero, G-U-E-R-O-T, has been promoting the disappearance of the nation state in Europe and advocating something that the Germans call Volksgruppenrecht, or the right of native peoples, in basically a sort of a geographical manifestation of identity politics. In addition to endorsing the secession of Catalonia, Ulrika Guerot, G-U-E-R-O-T, has also endorsed the secession of Flanders from Belgium and the Tyrol from northern Italy. One of the things that is worth noting in this particular article and in that particular ideological stance is that just such an endorsement of basically European regions as opposed to European nation states has a long history. And beyond that, that history is at one with the history of European fascism. Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister and one of the most intractable advocates and implementers of the austerity program that has beggared much of the European Union, including, by the way, Spain as a whole. And Spain's economic problems are one of the things that has helped to fuel the drive for secession by Catalonia, currently, by the way, being squashed by the Spanish Republic. Wolfgang Schäuble, in the early 1980s, was president of the Association of European Border Regions, and as such was helping to advocate a policy that had incorporated the stance of a number of Third Reich veterans and associates. Wolfgang Schäuble was the president of the Association of European Border Regions. And in another German Foreign Policy.com article, this from October 11th of 2017, titled "The Power in the Center," we note some of the participants in the AEB are along with Wolfgang Schäuble. And again, they were advocating a very similar orientation in which regions, and in particular very prosperous regions, would basically achieve autonomy from the nation states in which they are incorporated. That was something that was basically the regionalist concept was promoted by Wolfgang Schäuble. And among the people who worked with him in the AEBR, again, the Association of European Border Regions, quoting now from the article from GermanForeignPolicy.com, Power in the Center, former Nazi functionaries were actively participating both on the AEBR's committees and in the immediate entourage of its planning of the, quote, regionalization, unquote, of the border regions, including Gerd Jans, J-A-N-S, the former member of the Waffen-SS in the Netherlands, Konrad Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, responsible for the Nazis' Generalplan Ost, their plan for Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, Hermann Josef Ads, the head of the Deutsche Bank, as well as Alfred Topfer, T-O-E-P-F-E-R, described by the publicist Hans Rudiger Minow as, quote, infamous for his border subversion of France's Alsace region. And one of the things that is worth noting is that the AEBR, incorporating all of those people, Hermann Abs, head of Deutsche Bank, arguably the most important German banker of the Hitler period and the early post-World War II decades, the continuity between the AEBR that was headed up by Wolfgang Schäuble, again, the current German finance minister and chief advocate and implementer of the austerity policy, was the continuity between Nazi concepts and the regionalist stance of the AEBR. Again, Catalonia is one of the areas whose secession has been advocated by that particular stance. And Ulrika Guiró's position paper and accompanying maps in the weekly Die Zeit. Something to note in that regard, and we will go into this at greater length. I will put the articles and links in the written description for this program. Two of the leading advocates for the secession of Catalonia, implementing that advocacy through tweets, were none other than Julian Assange and also Edward Snowden, both of whom felt that it was absolutely the right of any region to secede. That is interesting to me for a variety of reasons. Some elements of German reaction have taken that stance, and in past programs we've noted not only the continuity between the WikiLeaks and Snowden ops both, and I can appreciate that for newer listeners what I'm about to say may sound absolutely preposterous, but both WikiLeaks and Team Snowden, to coin the term, are as far to the right as you can possibly get, with strong links not only to German fascism, but also to the neo-Confederate movement as manifested through Ron Paul and the closely associated Ludwig von Mises Institute, something we will come back to in connection with Brazil in a later discussion. Of course, the neo-Confederate movement not only felt that the Confederacy was justified, they are pro-slavery, they feel that the South should secede again. Ron Paul, the presidential candidate of choice by Julian Assange, as well as Edward Snowden, who contributed to Ron Paul's campaign and whose first attorney was the Bruce Fein, was the chief legal counsel for Ron Paul's 2012 campaign, and also the attorney for the Snowden family. Ron Paul is joined at the hip with the neo-Confederate movement and also the Ludwig von Mises Institute. We most recently covered that in For the Record program number 972. There was a recent election in Germany, and the alternative for Germany, or AfD, won something like 13% of the votes and will have 93 seats in the Bundestag. Many analysts don't see that as particularly alarming because they don't feel that other parties will form coalitions with the AfD. I would note, however, as the Quartz blog of September 25th of 2017 has noted in an article by Jill Petzinger, P-E-T-Z-I-N-G-E-R, the leader of Germany's far-right party quit hours after its election success. And Frauke, F-R-A-U-K-E, Petry, P-E-T-R-Y, who herself had become something of a poster child or poster adult for resurgent German reaction, quit the AfD because she felt it was too radical. And a fellow named Alexander Gauland, or Gauland, G-A-U-L-A-N-D, advocated basically that Germans should no longer feel weighted or ashamed of Germany's Nazi past. And beyond that, that they should take pride in the accomplishments of German soldiers during the Second World War. And as is the case in many other countries in Europe and also in the U.S., anti-Muslim sentiment and anti-immigrant sentiment play a key role in the ideology of the AfD. In Austria, the Freedom Party is being seen as probably going to enjoy a considerable measure of success in the upcoming Austrian election, and that would place it in a coalition government in the Austrian parliamentary system. Europe generally has parliamentary democracies, and so electoral success results in the formation of a governing coalition. An interesting historical juxtaposition is contained in a Reuters article of October 10th of 2017 from the Reuters.com website. Austria's Freedom Party suspends member over Nazi allegations. This concerns the suspension of Josef Reimer, R-I-E-M-E-R, a Freedom Party parliamentarian, for reportedly giving the Nazi salute. And while that, at a superficial level, might seem to be welcome, what is interesting, and in my opinion somewhat hypocritical, is that the Freedom Party itself, best known for its late leader, Jürg Haider, the so-called yuppie fascist, the Austrian Freedom Party was formed in 1956 specifically as a vehicle for introducing former Austrian Nazis and Third Reich veterans into the Austrian political process. So I think, although certainly poised to enjoy electoral success, purging Josef Reimer or Reimer for having given a Nazi salute would appear to be a practical move for the Freedom Party. In an historical and ideological sense, it is grossly hypocritical, since the Freedom Party was formed as a vehicle for, again, introducing Third Reich Nazi veterans into the Austrian political process. Another interesting echo of the past is contained in the Politico.eu blog of December 6th of 2016. An article by Jonathan Brown, Baltic Minutemen Fight Russian Foe, discusses the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union and how they are coordinating with other military or paramilitary formations in the former Baltic states of Latvia and Estonia. They are coordinating specifically with the Latvian National Guard and the Estonia Defense League, and their maneuvering is aimed at sharpening their military prowess because of their fears that Russia will annex the Baltic states again. I don't think that is very likely to happen. This in the wake of the Ukrainian crisis, in which, frankly, the Russian point of view is absolutely accurate. The OUNB fascists from World War II were put right back in power in Ukraine. Russia has not invaded Ukraine, although they have lent some support to the ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, who basically do not want to be part of a neo-Nazi or recrudescent Nazi government in Ukraine. And Ukraine, by the way, being split between ethnic Russians in the east and Ukrainians in Galicia or western Ukraine, whose historical antecedents lie more with the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Western Ukraine was part of that empire. It also was an epicenter of Ukrainian fascism in World War II. Crimea, which had been part of Russia for roughly 150 years, until Khrushchev in 1954 assigned it to Ukraine, basically was able to fulfill a long-held desire to get out of Ukraine, which was a cesspool of corruption. Their desire to get out of Ukraine had been ignored by the Yeltsin government. Finally, Putin basically seeing Russia being boxed in and potentially isolated from access to the Baltic Sea, to the Black Sea, I should say, granted Crimea its wish. There was a plebiscite in Crimea, and although Americans are fundamentally ignorant of what is going on in Ukraine, it is not frankly surprising that the Crimeans would have chosen not to be part of a resurgent Nazi government in Ukraine. And the tsunami of propaganda in this country and in Europe about how that is just foolish simply will not wash. Anyway, that is something of a digression. Do note, however, the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union and its maneuvering with similar formations in Estonia and Latvia. In a Global Post article of September 2nd of 2014, an Agence France Presse article titled "Russian Threat Sees Rebirth of Lithuania Paramilitary Group." Some of the history of the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union is detailed. We've gone into this in past programs. A bit of, although it was formed in 1919, one of its more noteworthy historical chapters is detailed in that Agence France-Presse article. Its reputation is, however, tainted by allegations that certain members were involved in a series of Nazi massacres between 1940 and 1944 that claimed the lives of an estimated 80 to 100,000 Jews, Poles, and Russians in Panierai, P-A-N-I-E-R-A-I, a suburb skirting the capital, Vilnius. The Riflemen's Union was banned in 1940 by the Soviet Union when the Red Army swept in from the east to occupy Lithuania during World War II, but members fought a guerrilla war against the Soviets until the early 1950s. In AFA Program 37, among other broadcasts, we have noted that Lithuania was the second fascist country in Europe. In 1925, it formally went fascist following Italy in 1922. It was occupied temporarily by the Soviet Union following the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and then after the Nazi armies swept into the former Soviet Union, it allied itself with the Third Reich, and it participated in the various ethnic cleansings implemented by the Nazis. And that was where the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union it was in those ethnic cleansings that the Lithuanian Riflemen's Union participated. Noting the following as well from that same Agence France-Presse article. The Riflemen's Union was banned in 1940 by the Soviet Union when the Red Army swept in from the east to occupy Lithuania during World War II, but members fought a guerrilla war against the Soviets until the early 1950s. In AFA program number 1, and also in For the Record 777, we noted that in both Ukraine and the Baltic states and parts of Poland, guerrilla formations originally formed by and allied with the Third Reich, composed of ethnic Ukrainians, Poles, and Lithuanians, carried on a guerrilla war, many of them with their former Wehrmacht and Waffen-SS officers, until the early 1950s. Perhaps more importantly, those guerrilla units were supported by the Office of Policy Coordination that ultimately morphed into the CIA's Directorate of Plans. It was headed up initially by Frank Wisner. Its number two guy was a guy named Carmel Offie, C-A-R-M-E-L-O-F-F-I-E. Again, we went into that in AFA program number one. It basically was a continuation of the military combat in Eastern Europe, switching to small unit guerrilla actions from more conventional, broad-based frontal military action. And that was supported by the fledgling CIA, although OPC originally was sort of a combination of State Department and CIA. It was a combination CIA and State Department unit. The point being that the U.S. actually supported a continuation of the combat in Eastern Europe until the early 1950s. Again, a more detailed account of that in AFA program number one, and for the record, 777. I would also note that in Ukraine, we have recently seen a commemoration of the efforts, I guess one could say. Simon Petliura, an early Ukrainian nationalist who in the immediate post-World War I period had armies that liquidated some 50,000 Jews, has officially had a holiday named after him. That is, sadly, only too characteristic of what is taking place in contemporary Ukraine. In the city of Lvov, or Lviv, depending on the transliteration from the Cyrillic alphabet, the liquidation of the Jewish population of Lvov during World War II by the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, or Nightingale Battalion, headed up by Roman Shukevich, the head of the Ukrainian Partisan Army, the military wing of the OUNB, Ukrainian Fascist Organization, headed up by Stefan Bandera. Lvov has commemorated June 30th as Shukevich Fest, an official celebration of Roman Shukevich on the anniversary of the liquidation of Lvov's Jewish population in a pogrom that was performed by the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, formed by the German army, headed up by Roman Shukevich with a guy named Theodor Oberlander, a very important SS officer and later for a time the German minister of Ex-Palais, a fellow who exerted a very important influence both on Third Reich's military and ethnic policy, and who then became a key functionary of Charles Willoughby's International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture. We went into that in AFA 14 and a number of different For the Record shows. There is now a commemoration of the of Roman Shukevich on the anniversary of that pogrom in Lvov. It is that kind of activity that basically helped to spur not only the attempted secession of ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, but also the Crimeans. By the way, in Ukraine now, because of the lustration laws, it is a crime to criticize the UPA or the OUNB. If I were to do in Ukraine what I just did, it would be a criminal offense. You cannot talk about units like the 14th Waffen-SS Division, the Galician Division, or the 36th Waffen-SS Panzer Grenadier Brigade, or smaller units like the Roland and Nightingale battalions, which were drawn from ethnic Ukrainians or composed of ethnic Ukrainians, if one were to tell the truth about their collaboration with the Third Reich, the liquidation of Poles in the Ukrainian-Polish War, sort of a sub-conflict of the Second World War in Ukraine and Poland, or the liquidations of ethnic Russians or Jews, you would be arrested. That is now a crime in Ukraine. Moving from Europe to Latin America, there was a very interesting development in Argentina, covered in the Washington Post of June 20th of 2017, in an article by Max Bierak, B-E-A-R-A-K, behind the bookcase, a secret passageway leads to a trove of Nazi artifacts in Argentina. And it notes again that behind the bookcase there was a passageway that had a huge cache of Nazi artifacts, including photographs, as we will see, some instruments used for measuring the cranial capacity of people to see if they were deemed inferior. And the story notes that Argentina, as is very well known, was an epicenter of the Nazi diaspora during World War II. Again, Argentina was a major epicenter of the Nazi diaspora. We have noted in past discussions of the AMIA bombing. That was a bombing in 1994 of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, that was also a repository for a large archive about Nazi fugitives who had fled to Argentina from Germany. Alberto Misman, M-I-S-M-A-N, an Argentine prosecutor who had been looking into that case, was found dead, an alleged suicide. Many people were skeptical of that. Now, a new investigation has found that, in fact, his death was a murder. The AMIA bombing has a number of different evidentiary tributaries. Nisman was accusing the government of Isabel Kirchner of covering it up to hide a proposed deal between Argentina and Iran, an oil deal in which the Argentines, in exchange for covering up alleged Iranian links to the AMIA bombing, would receive oil from Argentina. Kirchner's death, and we will talk about this when we do a more detailed analysis of, really when we do a more detailed examination of our Latin American branch of the Fascism 2017 World Tour. Alberto Nisman's death has definitely been found to be a murder. Among the aspects of that bombing that remain to be investigated. Again, the AMIA building was a repository of a very important archive of Nazi fugitives in Argentina. Manzer Alcazar and associates of his may very well have provided the explosives for that bombing. Manzer Alcazar was a key player in the Iran-Contra scandal. He arranged a major shipment of East Bloc weapons for the Contras, the Nicaraguan Contra guerrillas fighting the Sandinista government, and used the Merex Company to do that. Merex is an arms dealer that was founded by Otto Skorzeny and Gerhard Mertens. Skorzeny, the SS commando extraordinaire and one of Hitler's favorites, a major functionary of the Odessa network in the post War period. Gerhard Mertens, his collaborator, also a Third Reich military veteran, his collaborator in founding the Marex Company. More about what was found in that trove of Nazi artifacts behind the bookcase and through a passageway in Argentina. A Jewish Telegraphic Agency article of June 14th of 2017. Tools used in Nazi medical experiments uncovered in Argentina. This maintains that, as excerpting here briefly, one suspect identified by the police is not in Argentina. There are Argentine and non-Argentinian suspects being investigated, but no further details have been provided. What is interesting and possibly significant is the identity of the judge who is investigating this discovery of Nazi artifacts. The judge in the case is Sandra Arroyo Salgado, the widow of prosecutor Alberto Niesman. Salgado imposed a gag order on the investigation, so no further details were revealed. And again, the photographs of high-ranking Nazi officials and various Nazi artifacts, including instruments apparently used in Nazi medical experiments, were found in this archive. Whether there is any link between the archive and the AMIA center, which was blown up, that bombing being investigated by Alberto Niesman, whose death is now confirmed to have been a murder, and whose widow, Sandra Arroyo Salgado, is investigating this discovery of Nazi artifacts. Well, we do not know. Perhaps we will never find out. It certainly is interesting and what I call food for thought and grounds for further research. Also in Latin America, and providing a number of evidentiary tributaries to past programs and other things that we have spoken about in this program, from the Brazil Wire of August 19th of 2017, Brazil's U.S.-funded libertarians and the far right. And this talks about a fellow named Christopher Cantwell, C-A-N-T-W-E-L-L, who is an American Nazi who helped to organize the Charlottesville protests in Virginia. And he has been networking with the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Brazil, or its Brazilian chapter, the MBL. Again, that is the, the MBL is the Movimento Brasil Livre. That is a political front associated with the Mises Institute and the Koch brothers, Students for Liberty. And Mr. Cantwell has been networking with that particular milieu in Latin America. And again, we will go into this in greater detail in programs to come. It's worth noting that Mr. Cantwell was wearing T-shirts that appeared to have endorsed the tactic of abducting political captives and executing them by throwing them out of helicopters. This was practiced by the Pinochet regime in Chile, also the Argentinian junta during the Dirty War of the 1970s. And again, artistic endorsement of that tactic by Mr. Cantwell. Again, Christopher Cantwell, one of the American Nazi organizers of the neo-Confederate protests in Virginia, has been networking with the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Brazil. The Ludwig von Mises Institute in Alabama has not only been financed by the Koch brothers, but again has, as we talked about earlier in the program, has very strong links to the neo-Confederate movement. More about this in upcoming programs. Something else that we're going to go into at much greater length and in much greater detail, an article from BuzzFeed of October 5th of 2017, Pivoting North and Going Back to North America, that last article being about a North American slash American fascist link to the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Brazil, again financed by the Koch brothers, and with some very strong fascist links in Brazil. This article is by Joseph Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N. It's called Alt-Right, How the Breitbart Machine Laundered Racist Hate. And what this article goes into is how Breitbart, again headed up by Steve Bannon, who was for a time the most important of Donald Trump's advisors. He was on the National Security Council at one point, and he was Donald Trump's campaign manager for a period of time, also with a background in Goldman Sachs. Breitbart was more than just a right-wing propaganda vehicle. What this article goes into is how specifically Breitbart was reaching out to alienated white youth, and specifically going out of its way to recruit alienated white youth to a Nazi point of view. A fellow named Milo Yiannopoulos, Milo, of course, M-I-L-O, Yiannopoulos, Y-A-N-N-O-P-O-U-L-O-S, a fellow who has had a lot of publicity recently, also sort of an extravagant gay fellow as well, extravagant in his manner of dress and expression. Perhaps he could be seen as something of a latter-day Ernst Rome in that regard. Yiannopoulos was one of the fellows who, again, was working inside of the Breitbart apparatus to specifically recruit alienated white youth to a Nazi point of view, while at the same time going out of his, their way to downplay the overt Nazi slash white supremacist outreach of Breitbart. And among the people he worked with there was Andrew Auernheimer, the web architect for the Daily Stormer website. He operates under the nickname of Weave. He is currently holding forth in Ukraine. He is, among other things, a brilliant hacker, and among other things, was also a guest at the reception by Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras to celebrate their receipt of the prestigious Polk Award, P-O-L-K. One of the people that Milo Yiannopoulos has been working with, and again, we will go into this at greater length, was none other than Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is one of the largest stockholders in Facebook, and the largest stockholder in Palantir. That is a company that manufactures counter-terrorist surveillance software and appears to have been the architect, not him personally, but the Palantir appears to have developed the PRISM software that figured in the Snowden, quote, revelations, unquote, although they deny that. They claim their PRISM counter-terrorist software is different from the PRISM counter-terrorist software that the NSA was using I would take that with a huge dose of salt. But Peter Thiel, again, a very important member of Team Trump, has been working with Milo Yiannopoulos and company in this Nazi slash white supremacist outreach through Breitbart to alienated white youth. Peter Thiel, recall, provided most of the capital for white supremacist Ron Paul's super PAC. Ron Paul, the presidential candidate of choice, as we mentioned earlier, not only for Julian Assange, but for Edward Snowden as well. Ron Paul joined at the hip with the Ludwig von Mises Institute and the neo-Confederate movement, and again, Team Snowden, to coin a term. This is a long story, this BuzzFeed story, and will in and of itself occupy a major portion of an upcoming broadcast. Other participants in this outreach are a fellow named Devin Saucier, founder of a defunct white nationalist student group, Youth for Western Civilization. And I would also note again that in addition to, not again, but I would note that in addition to Breitbart, YouTube has been a major vehicle for outreach by fascist elements to young people, alienated white youth in particular, both with Breitbart and also with the YouTube effort documented in Right Wing Watch of October of 2017, an article by Jared, J-A-R-E-D, Holt, White Supremacy Figured Out How to Become YouTube Famous, and we're going to talk about that as well. This could be thought of as something of a cyber serpent's walk scenario in which the opinion-forming media, in this case online opinion-forming outlets, are used to basically convert America to a fascist slash Nazi point of view. And we are going to go into this at greater length in weeks to come. We're running low on time, so I think we're not going to be able to come anywhere close even to our overview of Fascism 2017 World Tour. But turning to the Middle East, I've taken a lot of fresh fertilizer over my discussion of the fascist element in the Zionist movement. And while I'm not maintaining that the Zionist movement as a whole is fascist, its right wing and the Israeli right wing of Benjamin Netanyahu are most assuredly fascist. And I'm sorry, I've taken a lot of crap about that, but the evidence is very strong. The Likud party sent a fellow named Yudi Cohen to the National Convention of the Alleanza Nazionale in Italy in the late 1990s. That is the successor organization to Mussolini's Fascisti, and the U.S. Republican Party sent a representative as well. That's pretty fascist. I've also spoken about Vladimir Yabotinsky, who was the head of the Beitar, the first and most important fascist element in the Zionist movement. He allied with Mussolini for a time, and the Beitar supported Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, which they saw as a triumph of white Europeans over inferior Africans. They saw the Zionist movement itself as such a manifestation. The Beitar took military training at Mussolini's Naval Cadet School. They were reviewed by Mussolini. They collected scrap metal to support Mussolini's forces in Ethiopia. And they were reviewed by Mussolini himself and sang the Italian fascist anthem. Yabotinsky himself did not think that the workers in the projected Zionist entity should be, or Zionist country should be permitted to strike, and he allied himself with the aforementioned Simon Petliura. Apologists for Jabotinsky have maintained that he did so out of a sort of Jewish Lives Matter orientation. Simon Petliura was a butcher whose forces, again, he's now being celebrated in Ukraine. His forces liquidated 50,000 Jews in the wake of World War I, and he was an ally for a time of Vladimir Jabotinsky. I have also spoken about Bormann Jews in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It mentions that the remarkable and deadly post-war Bormann Flight Capital Network went out of its way to use Jewish front people in its enterprises, and that they were responsible for channeling some key money to Israel, and as such, Israel was helping to cover that up. I would note a New York Times story from February 8th of 2017 by Isabel Kershner, K-E-R-S-H-N-E-R. Submarine case is haunting Netanyahu at a critical time. And what this talks about is the very strong links between the Netanyahu regime and ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. The Thyssen firm and ThyssenKrupp being the largest heavy industrial firm in Western Europe. Thyssen firm is a linchpin of the Bormann Flight Capital Network. And the Netanyahu government in Israel has been very close to ThyssenKrupp and actively lobbied on behalf of ThyssenKrupp for some contracts for patrol boats and submarines for the Israeli Navy. That is now a focal point of investigation by Israeli authorities. More about that, more about Netanyahu and ThyssenKrupp in programs to come. I would also note that Netanyahu's son, Yair Netanyahu, has used some fascist and anti-Semitic images in his criticism of his father's critics. More about that in upcoming programs. An article from Haaretz of August 16th of 2017. And we were at Netanyahu's son, neo-Nazi scum, belong to the past, far-left thugs getting stronger. And I would also note an article from not only the Israeli press, but also from the Huffington Post. I would note the use of Nazi and anti-Semitic images and concepts by Netanyahu's son, accusing George Soros, among others, of conspiring against his father. Again, I apologize for some bumpiness due to lack of time. One thing I want to get to before we leave our Fascism 2017 World Tour of the Middle East. In the past, we have spoken about the Muslim Brotherhood, that is an Islamic fascist organization that is the parent organization of Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and many of the Islamic fundamentalist guerrilla and terrorist groups from the Afghan Mujahideen, again to Al-Qaeda and Hamas. They are viewed with great favor by the transnational corporate community and their neoliberal laissez-faire advocates. Ibn Khaldun is viewed by the World Bank as the first advocate of privatization. There is a Newsweek article from 2006 by Stephen Glain, G-L-A-I-N, about that we have spoken of in the past. The New York Times of October 2nd of 1981, Reagan cites Islamic Scholar by Robert D. McFadden. Ronald Reagan in 1981 cited Ibn Khaldun as the father of supply-side economics. More about that, however, when we go into detail in our 2017 Fascism World Tour program when we visit the Middle East. However, we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 983, Fascism 2017 World Tour Part 2. This is being recorded on November 7th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.